Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
It's also my great duty and pleasure tonight to introduce our speaker.
Oh.
Who has travelled a long way. Can I introduce Tim from Ohio?
Thank you, my friend. Thanks for that wonderful welcome. It's nice to be here. I want to take a moment just to thank the people that made it possible, the people that worked to get this thing together, and to have a place for us to be tonight together. Let's give them a round of applause. Now, you know, I'm pretty sure what I'm going to say up here tonight, but I'm not pretty sure what you're going to hear. Huh? And there's a story I like to tell. It's a story about a policeman in the States. And he's sitting on the side of the road waiting for somebody to go by and do something wrong, because that's what they do. And sure enough, on one day, a boy came driving by in a pickup truck. The back of that pickup truck was full of penguins. And that police officer knew there was something wrong with that, so he pulled him over. He says, "Son, where are you going with all those penguins in the back of that pickup truck?" He said, "Well, officer, we're not going anywhere. We're just out for a ride." He said, "Well, son, you can't take penguins for a ride. What's wrong with you? Take those penguins to the zoo." The next day, that cop sitting in the same place. Here comes that boy in a pickup truck one more time. The back of that pickup truck still full of penguins. But on that day, all those penguins are wearing sunglasses. And he knows there's something wrong with that, so he pulled them over again. And he says, "Son, I thought I told you to take those penguins to the zoo." He said, "Well, yes, sir, I did. Today we're going to the beach." Now, we all kind of see and hear things differently, don't we? We can be looking at the same person, listening to the same person. You're going to see one thing. I'm going to see one thing. You're going to hear one thing. I'm going to hear one thing. Let me give you an example. There's a room, a big room like this. Sitting in the middle of the room is a table. In the middle of that table, there's a $100 bill. Now, standing around that table is the perfect man, the perfect woman, Santa Claus, and the Easter Bunny. And the lights went out. When those lights went back on, that $100 bill was gone. Now, who do you think took it? We all know it had to be the perfect woman because those other three things don't exist. My name's Tim Towsley. I'm an alcoholic. And you know, I didn't want to be an alcoholic. My daddy was an alcoholic. He was a member of this fellowship. He got sober in 1945. He passed away in 1980. He had 10 years of continuous sobriety put together at that time in his life. And what that did for me early in my life, it gave me an opportunity to see what an alcoholic was all about. To see what alcoholism was all about. And also to see what Alcoholics Anonymous was all about. I came from a family where I had 6 stepfathers. I had 13 stepmothers. I went to over 20 schools. I never got out of the 8th grade. I've been married 3 times and divorced twice. I left home when I was 15 years old. I've had an opportunity in my life to spend time in boys' homes and detention homes, city jails and county jails, workhouses, psych wards, treatment centers, and penitentiaries. I spent 12 years of my adult life either on parole, probation, or locked behind some kind of door somewhere. And do you know not one of those things I just mentioned are the reasons I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous? Those were merely the situations that my disease of alcoholism created in my life. But on June 23rd, 1982, I woke up at the bottom. It's the bottom they talk about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's when you know a loneliness such as few men know. It's when you're at that jumping off place. You're wishing for the end. You can no longer imagine life with or life without alcohol. And that's the bottom. Now, that's not a high bottom, see. But it's not a low bottom either. It's simply my bottom. And my bottom is the only bottom. I ever need to concern myself with in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't ever want to be in a position in my sobriety where I can sit in a room of alcoholics, listen to a speaker speak, and start thinking things like, you know, maybe I wasn't that bad, huh? Or maybe I was worse. Because as soon as I can sit out there and I can make myself believe I'm different in any way from anybody else sitting in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, as soon as I can sit out there and make myself believe I'm unique in any way from anybody in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, then I've got reservations, don't I? And there was an old timer in Berea, Ohio, where I got sober, used to tell me all the time, he said, Tim, if you got reservations, son, you must be going somewhere, huh? And I don't want to go anywhere today. I like it here. I had my first drink at 13. I got sick. I blacked out. I passed out. I woke up in the backyard of a lady's house in Rocky River, Ohio. I had my last drink at 30. I got sick. I blacked out. I passed out. And I woke up at home in bed. And that's really the only difference. 17 years of use and abuse. The only real difference was where I woke up the next morning. But there's one thing I know for sure today. I know God wants me here in Alcoholics Anonymous. That lady came out of her back door. She found me in her backyard. She took me in her house. She cleaned me up. She found out who I was. She called my mama, let my mama know I was okay. 17 years later, I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sober about 2 weeks. I went to a meeting. And that woman was speaking at the meeting. Huh? My very first drunk, I found myself in the arms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she did for me that night all she knew how to do. She was sober about 60 days when she found me in her backyard. And what they told her to do at her home group was help a drunk. And that's what she did. They didn't tell her only help the old drunks or the young drunks, the male drunks or the female drunks, the white drunks, the black drunks. They just told her to help a drunk. Period. And that's what she did that night. Do you know I still see that woman at meetings today? She's over 80 years old and over 40 years sober, and you know what she's doing? She's helping drunks. Now, there's two things I ran from most of my life. I'm not crazy about them today. I have an awful lot of them in my life today, and I still don't like them. I just don't run from them. I deal with them. And those two things are responsibility and authority. Huh? I don't like being responsible. There's a lot of responsibility involved with being responsible, you know. And I certainly don't like people telling me I'm supposed to be responsible. And at 14 years old, everybody in my life had an idea about Tim's life. How long his hair should be, how tight his jeans should be, go to school, don't go to school, how high the heels on my boots should be. Everybody had an idea about Tim. No one asked Tim what he thought. I'm at a family gathering. I'm about 13, 14 years old. I'm listening to people talk, and I heard somebody say this. They said, my daddy, my real father, was in New Orleans, and he was sober. And with that information, I left home the next day because I knew what my problem was. It wasn't what I was doing or who I was doing it with. My problem was I didn't have my real father in my life. And if I could get my real father in my life, everything would be okay. I made my way to New Orleans. I contacted Alcoholics Anonymous. They found my daddy for me, and they put us together. And all of a sudden, I had a father, and he had a son. And we tried to be those two things, but it just didn't work. After about 3 months, my father started drinking again. And I can remember coming home at 13 and 14 years old, falling into my mother's living room, drunk and passing out, and having her scream at me, saying, Tim, don't drink. Please don't drink. You'll get what your father has. But I never watched my father drink before, so I didn't know what she was trying to keep me from getting. But I watched him drink. I watched him get drunk. I watched him go into the DTs. I watched the people from Alcoholics Anonymous come into our little house, take him away, and put him in Bridge House in New Orleans. And I made a decision on that day. I'm not going to be an alcoholic. I'm not going to end up like my daddy ended up. And I didn't have another drink for the next 4 years. I didn't really do anything for the next 4 years. Not much of anything. I just hitchhiked all around the United States. If I woke up in Los Angeles and I didn't like it there, I'd go to Denver. Denver didn't please me. It was off to Dallas. I didn't like Dallas. I'd go to Miami. You see, I had 4 good years. My expectations were met. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me this, that my expectations are inversely proportional to my serenity level. And I don't know about you, but I can tell you a little bit about me today. Do you know if I get exactly, now I mean exactly, what I think I'm supposed to have, exactly when I think I'm supposed to have it? I'm a pretty happy guy, huh? But as soon as I don't, my expectations aren't met and my serenity level goes down. I'm outside Salt Lake City. Me and a buddy of mine are leaving California and I'm coming home. I'm going back to Ohio. And we got a ride from Berkeley into Utah. I don't know if you know much about the United States, but Utah is a pretty desolate spot. There's nothing there. And we got dropped off at an off-ramp in the middle of Utah, in the middle of the mountains. There is nothing at this off-ramp. There's no convenience stores, there's no houses, there's no people, there's no nothing. It's just a road that goes up into the mountains to a ski resort, probably. And that's where we got dropped off that night. We woke up the next morning about froze to death. Walked down to the bottom of the ramp to start hitchhiking east. And sitting in the middle of Utah, in the middle of nowhere, all by itself, is a six-pack of Olympia beer. Huh? I know God wants me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was my next drink. I drank three beers. He drank three beers. I looked at him. I said, you know, if I ever get back to Cleveland alive, I'm settling down. I'm going to marry the first girl I see. But you got to have a wife. That's all part of our American dream. You got to have the stuff. And I wanted some of the stuff. You know the stuff. They got it here. You got the billboards that tell us if we drive this kind of car, we're okay. If we live in that kind of neighborhood, we're okay. If we wear these kind of clothes, then we're okay. And all of a sudden, at 18 years old, I want to be okay. We got back to Cleveland. My stepfather wasn't home. I was allowed in the house. I went in the house, changed my clothes, took a shower, borrowed my mother's car, drove to the corner to pick a young lady up hitchhiking, and we got married. Now, we get married that day. Well, we would have. But in the state of Ohio back then, the male had to be 21 without parental consent, and the female had to be 18 without parental consent. And when I married my first wife, she was 15 and I was 18. And this was not a marriage that was made in heaven. Huh? We didn't know anything about being married. We didn't know anything about being in love. We really didn't know anything about anything. But I can tell you this about this. I don't know if I loved her. And I can't tell you to this day if I did. But at that time in my life, I live in my brother's van in the driveway of my parents' home because I haven't been allowed in their house since I'm 15 years old. She lives wherever she can because there's things going on in her house she just doesn't want to go back to. And that brought us together. We weren't alone anymore. And that was enough, just not to be alone anymore. And it was a simple marriage. I got up in the morning, I got drunk. She got up in the morning, she got drunk. And then we'd beat each other up, huh? And we did that one day at a time for about 7 years. But out of that 7 years, I was away a lot. I travel a lot. I travel a lot then. I travel a lot now. I just travel all the time. But this was a different part of my life. I'd go into a room, be a big room like this. And sitting in the front of the room, there'd be a man. And he'd have a long black coat on. And every time he did this, I went somewhere. I was just always in trouble. Seemed like I spent 12 years of my life only doing two things. I was getting ready to go to jail, or I was getting ready to come home from being in jail. I just got arrested a lot. I wasn't a violent criminal. I was a stupid criminal. I got arrested for stupid stuff. I got arrested for stuff like verbal abuse of a police officer. I got arrested for obscene finger language to a police officer. I was at a meeting one night. I was about 2 years sober. I don't know about anybody else. 2 years sober, I was pretty close to the smartest person in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 2 years sober. And there was a guy talking. You ever hear, this ever happened to you? You go to a meeting. There's somebody speaking. You know you've heard that person say that exact same things 50 times, right? But now, all of a sudden, it makes sense to you. There was a long timer. His name was Vic. Vic passed on. He was a great man. He helped me a lot. He was one of those guys. You got one of those guys? When you go to a meeting, you see him at the meeting, They don't even have to know you're there, but you feel better just knowing they are. And Vic stood up here and he talked that night, and he talked, I've heard him talk 50 times, and he said this that night. He said, I've been arrested 63 times. I wasn't a good criminal. Man, I picked right up on that, you know. I know I've been charged with 63 crimes. I wasn't a good criminal. People got caught as often as I got caught doing what they were doing, or good at what they were doing. It's just that simple. But in that verbal abuse case of a police officer, I found something else out. You see, I decided to represent myself in that case. And I called witnesses. I cross-examined witnesses. I gave my final arguments to the judge. Y'all know what I found out, right? I'm not a very good attorney either, man. Back to the workhouse. And that's just the way my life was going. 1975, I stood in front of a judge in an old Lakeside courthouse in downtown Cleveland, Ohio, and he sentenced me to 20 to 40 years in the penitentiary. And I took a big sigh of relief that day. I felt good that day. I could hear my wife and my mother in the back of the courtroom and they're crying. They don't think it's a good idea I go away, and they certainly don't want me to go for that long, but they don't know what I know. I know something on that day. You see, I know this. I know they can't send me anywhere that's going to hurt me as much as I've already hurt me. And that judge has no idea. There's no way on earth he can punish me as much as I've already punished myself. And I'm ready to go anywhere where I might have a better chance against myself. 1976, the laws in Ohio changed. My sentence went from a 20 to 40 to a 1 to 10, and 3 years later they sent me home. But when I got home, my stuff was gone. All the stuff I had to have so you could see I had it. And if you saw me with the stuff, you'd tell me I was okay because I couldn't tell myself. And all of that was gone. My car was gone. My bike was gone. My wife was gone. My clothes were gone. My jewelry was gone. Everything was gone. I left nothing but me. And I did nothing for the next 40 days but drink. I crawled into a bottle of alcohol. I got as drunk as I could, blacked out as I could, passed out as I could, as many times that day as I needed to. I crawled into a bottle. Not once in my life have I ever crawled into a bottle of alcohol to hide from you. I've never crawled into a bottle of alcohol to hide from them. I got as drunk as blacked out and passed out as I could get. I crawled in that bottle as many times as I needed to. Because if I was drunk enough, I didn't have to look. I crawled into a bottle to hide from me. Finally, a friend of mine came over, wasn't going to let me sit there anymore. Almost physically took me out of my house. He took me down to a little place in Cleveland, Ohio we call the Flats. And it used to just be a nice place to go get drunk, huh? That's what you did down there. You got drunk. You didn't go out for dinner. You didn't go down there on your boat. You didn't go down there to drink something that came from something called a microbrewery, huh? You drank past Blue Ribbon beer and Jim Beam bourbon and you got drunk and all the barroom floors were flooded. And that's what we did that night. We walked in a little bar. It was called the Pirate's Cove. My cousin's band was playing. They're playing a Marshall Tucker song. I'm about half in the bag. And this pretty little girl walked past me. And she smiled at me. You know, I smiled right back at her. And that was her. That was my future ex-wife. Who shall heretofore be known as the plaintiff. That's who that was. I want to tell you about my second wife because she brought some stuff with her when she came. She brought some things I think I had, I just don't know where they went. She brought stuff with her like honesty. She brought purity. She brought love and she brought unselfishness. These are the things she brought with her when she came. And 4 years later she left. And she only took one thing with her. And that was the disease of alcoholism. It stripped every decent thing that woman had. I'm not the only one I hurt when I pick up a drink. And I know that today. We tried for a number of years, for a couple of years, to do the right thing. I went to work. I never called in sick. I was never late. I stayed out of trouble and did the right thing for 2 years. And after 2 years, I'm sitting on my couch drunk. And I'm surveying my dynasty, huh? After 2 years. Do you know after 2 years of doing the right thing, I don't have a house on the lake? I don't have a Porsche in my driveway. I'm not wearing the right kind of clothes, and I'm certainly not running around with the right kind of people after 2 years, huh? So I came to a conclusion and made a decision that those things were for other people. And no matter how hard I worked to do the right thing, I'm just one of the people that's not supposed to have them. I woke up the next morning, called my boss, and quit my job. And the last 2 years of my drinking aren't too exciting. I got up, I got drunk. If I got up again, I got drunk again. After about 2 years, my wife had to go. She had to run for her life. And this is my life at 30 years old. You know those holidays we have? Christmas, Thanksgiving, Easter, whatever the case may be, we're going to go somewhere, aren't we? We're going to sit at a table, we'll hold hands, we'll say grace. We'll share a meal with each other. Then after we're done eating, we'll sit around and we'll share what's going on in each other's lives. This is the way it works at my house. I pull into my parents' driveway and I blow the horn. When they hear the horn inside, my little brother will come out of the back door. He'll have a paper plate in his hand wrapped in tinfoil. And he'll hand me my holiday meal. And I'm allowed to sit in my parents' driveway in my car and eat my holiday meal off a paper plate with a plastic knife and a plastic fork. I can't sit at their table. I can't hold their hands and say grace. I can't have a real napkin. And they certainly don't want me to share anything with them that's going on in my life at that time. But I don't want you to think they stopped loving me. Not even this much did their love diminish for me at that time. They simply realized that every time they reached down and stopped me from hitting my bottom, every time they allowed me not to be responsible for my own actions, they were killing me. You see, my parents loved me so much, they let me go. I don't have any children. I can only imagine how much love that must take. June 23rd, I woke up at that bottom I told you about, 1982. And I didn't know what to do, and I always did the same thing in my life when I didn't know what to do. I made a phone call, and I don't know if I made that phone call 100 times or 1,000 times. But it was a simple call, and it was always the same. It was, Mom, help. And my mom came, just like she always did. She walked into my little house. I'm kneeling on the living room floor. I'm shaking apart. I'm crying uncontrollably. I have hepatitis, and I weigh 112 pounds. And the first words out of my mother's mouth were, I'll kill her for doing this to you. Alcoholism. This is a family disease. Blaming others is a big part of this disease, and my mother has it too. We made some phone calls, and I found myself in an emergency room, and I got a doctor playing with my liver. And he says, son, you got an alcohol problem. And I said, no. Not me. He says, son, you got an alcohol problem. And I just didn't want to be an alcoholic. I was ready to be anything he wanted me to be, but that. He says, I don't care what you want to call yourself or want to be or don't want to be. If you don't quit drinking, you're going to die. And I heard him say that. And I spent the next 10 days in a psych ward on the east side of Cleveland. The first 3 in restraints. I'm powerless over alcohol. My life had become unmanageable. That sounded just a little bit like step one, didn't it? A little bit. I got a psychiatrist in my psych ward. I got the happiest psychiatrist on earth in my psych ward. And he comes to visit me every morning, happy. Tim, how you doing? Good to see you. Isn't it a marvelous day, he says. I don't know about the rest of y'all. 7 o'clock in the morning? In a psych ward on the east side of Cleveland? Tied to the bed? I'm not real spiritual. And I told him what I thought. And he just did what psychiatrists do. He died right in his chart. He nodded his head. That's what they do. Then they go away. And pretty soon they make you take that test. They got that test over here? Every time I went somewhere, they made me take the test, the MMPI test. If I had a nickel for every time I took that test, I wouldn't have to work today. It's got 600 questions on it. There's only one question on that test I can't answer. It's my favorite question on the whole MMPI test. It says, do you urinate more than most people? I don't know. I don't know. Now, on the third day, he came into my room, and I don't want to forget this day, ever. He put his chart in the windowsill. He undid the straps, and he sat on my bed. He said, Tim, I can't make your wife come home. I don't have a job to give you, won't make a house payment for you, but if you never, ever want to take another drink, as long as you live, I can tell you how to do that. One day at a time. You see, this psychiatrist was a recovering member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that God wants me here. He sat on my bed and he shared a little bit of his story with me. And then I shared a little bit of my story with him. And now, all of a sudden, it was no longer I'm powerless over alcohol, that my life had become unmanageable. All of a sudden, it became we. Huh? We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And that's step one. And I know today that without the we, I don't have a chance, man. 7 days later, he sent me home. He gave me my prescription, the most valuable thing anybody's ever given me in my life. He gave me a meeting schedule to Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, when you get home, I want you to do two things. You get to a meeting. When you get to the meeting, you get a sponsor. And I got home, and I didn't know what to do. And I told y'all what I do, and I don't know what to do. I called my mama. I said, Ma, I got to go to an AA meeting. She said, I'll come get you. See, my mom knows all about Alcoholics Anonymous. She went to meetings with my daddy in the 40s and the 50s. There's been a big book in our house as long as I can remember. And she took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was July 4th, and it was 1982. She dropped me on your doorstep. She left me with a little advice I want to share with you. She said, I'm not coming back to get you. You go to the front table, you tell the people at the front table you're new. You don't have a car, you don't have a driver's license, you need a ride home. And you stay away from the women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I paid attention to just about half of my mama's advice, but I got a sponsor that night. He gave me stuff to do. His wife was the chairperson that night. She handed me the traditions, asked me if I'd read them. And I backed up. I said, gee, I don't know, honey. You know, they just took the straps off me. You might mind if I find somebody else to do that. And then he just looked at me. You know how they look at you. He said, Tim, this is your first lesson in Alcoholics Anonymous. You never say no to Alcoholics Anonymous. No matter what the request is, the answer is yes. And that's all you're ever going to need to know about that. And then he gave me simple stuff to do. He said, if you have a coffee cup, throw it away. If you sat in a chair, put it away. He said, if you used an ashtray, this is a long time ago when AA was civilized, you empty it. He said, I want you to read one page of the big book every day. Don't turn that page until tomorrow. Read that page as many times that day as you want to or think you need to. Do not turn the page until tomorrow. And maybe in 164 days, you might know something about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, if you're not praying, this is how you're going to start. You're going to use three words your mother taught you when you were a little boy. You're going to get up in the morning and kneel down and you'll say, please. At the end of that day, you're going to kneel back down and you'll say, thank you. Please and thank you. You know, my mama taught me those words when I was a little boy. You know what she called them? It's the magic words. What's the magic word, Timmy? She used to say, no matter what I wanted, it was, what's the magic word? I had no idea how much magic those words held until I came here to you and you showed me how to use them. I came to believe by watching you my life would change if I did what you did, and that's what I did. I followed you around and I did exactly what you did, even if I didn't like doing what you did. You had cream in your coffee, I put cream in my coffee. I don't like cream in my coffee, huh? my sponsor and I knelt down to say the third step prayer. I don't know what y'all thought about the third step prayer. I've never been crazy about the third step prayer. Or the third step, for that matter. You know, I don't know what you thought first time you saw it, but first thing went through my mind was, what if it works? Huh? Then what? So my sponsor comes over and I say, all right, we're going to kneel down and I'm going to turn my will and my life over to care of God, right? And he said, that's right. And I said, then what? He said, we don't know. I said, oh, you don't know? What do you mean you don't know? You got to give me something here, right? And he did. He gave me a penny from the U.S. I don't know if you know about these. But if you look at the back of them, it just says, U.S. This is a special penny. This penny's from 1918 when my mama was born. It says 1 cent on the back of the penny. But you know what happens as soon as you turn it over? On the front of the penny, it says, in God, we trust. And that's the third step. In God, we trust. That step's not about God's will. That step is about my will. Am I willing to trust God one day at a time? Today I can tell you I am. There's another word on the bottom of that penny, and that word's liberty. The freedom I can have just by trusting God. And my sponsor asked me that question. You know, I'm kind of a firm believer. People, newcomers come in. I don't know, you probably, guys probably don't do it over here, but newcomers come into the fellowship, and we say some stupid stuff to them sometimes. Huh? You know, they'll come in and we'll tell them there's no such thing as a stupid question, right? Then we're going to ask them two or three stupid questions. And I don't know if your sponsor asked you. My sponsor asked me. He said, do you want what I have? I said, geez, I don't know, buddy. What do you got? You know, I tell you know, my sponsor had a brand new Tornado. He wore a Rolex watch. His wife was a flight attendant, had the prettiest green eyes I ever saw in my life. Do I want what you got? Yeah, what page is that on? That's what I want to know. Yeah. See, I didn't know what he was trying to give me. I didn't know what he was asking me. And I don't know about you, but when I got here, I did not want what you had. I knew that. But what I knew more is that when I got here, I did not want what I had. And God put people just like you in my path to show me another way. I started on that fourth step, but most of you guys are smart enough to know that's not one you want to rush right into, right? No, you really got to take your time with that fourth step because you got to read all them books. If we don't have anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, buddy. We got books. We got blue books. We got blue and blue books. We got little blue books, little black books, little red books, little green books. We got lists. We got guides. We even got experts in Alcoholics Anonymous today. And you got to read all them books. Talk to every old timer in the world. Or you're going to mess the fourth step up, aren't you? There's only one way to do the fourth step wrong. Don't do it. That's the only way to do the fourth step wrong is don't do it. I read all those books. I talked to every old timer in Ohio. I'm sober 30 years today. And I'm still not 100% sure what Mr. Jones's problem is. I'm sitting at home one night. My phone rings. It's my sponsor. He said, how's that four step coming? I said, oh, it's coming right along. Coming right along. And he gave me something. You shouldn't give your newcomer too much of this. He gave me information. He said, it'll get done in God's time. And you know, that's exactly what I was thinking too about the fourth step getting done. And I said, yeah, it'll get done in God's time. And I hung the phone up. 5 minutes later, my phone rings. It's my sponsor. He said, how's that fourth step coming, Tim? But I got something now, right? I got information. Gave it right back to him too. I said, it's going to get done in God's time. And he said, well, that's a good thing, because God's time is tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. My sponsor was always helping. You know, we'd be at a meeting and they'd say, we need coffee help next month. He'd sit behind me, raise my hand. Tim will do it. Tim still does it. My sponsor never told me to stop doing anything. He told me to start doing. He didn't say when I was sober 5 years I didn't have to read the book anymore. He didn't say when I was sober 10 years I didn't have to pray anymore. He never told me to stop doing anything. See, I'm the donut guy at my home group now. I bring the donuts. That's an important job. You know, anybody can make coffee, but... but I bring the donuts. And I always bring the same kind of donuts. You know, some people bring all those mix and match donuts. I bring the same kind. Because you know how drunks are, right? They'll get up at a box of donuts with 12 different donuts in it and stand there and scratch their head trying to make a decision. I bring the same donuts. Get a donut and move on. You know? I did a fourth and a fifth step. I wrote down what I did. I shared with God and another human being why it happened. And then I had to become entirely ready for that stuff to go away. But you know, I couldn't do that by myself. I had to humbly ask a power greater than myself for help. I just couldn't do it by myself. And that sent me to the list in my eighth step. And my sponsor's coming over, and we're going to go over this list because I'm going to get this 8 and 9 deal straightened out, right? And I'm looking at my list waiting for him to get there. And I'm looking at this guy over here. And you know, I did that to him. I don't dispute it. Guilty. I did it. But you know, he did this to me, right? Man, I scratched him off the list. That's a push. No, we're even. And I'm steady scratching people off the list waiting for my sponsor to get there. And when he gets there, there's no one on my list but my mama. And I'm really trying to find a way to get her off. He said, Tim, you don't understand this, do you? I said, I think I do. He said, no, you don't. He said, this has nothing to do with them. This is about you. Their faults will not be discussed. And then I had to go out and make direct amends to the people I've wronged. And I found out how the steps will work for me. If I go to make amends to another human being I've wronged, it's hard for me to take ego, resentment, self-pity, false pride with me to that door. Those character defects will slip away as I work the next steps. And that's how God works humbly in my life after I ask Him. And before I was halfway through, those promises came true. I got a great life today. I got that Porsche in the driveway today. Well, I keep it disguised as a Toyota, though. You know, and, you know, that's just so no one will steal it. Maybe someday you'll be in the U.S. and you'll see it. And you'll think, well, that's not a Porsche. That's a Toyota, but you got to remember this. There's only one person sitting here tonight that's looking out of your eyes. And that's the only person that's ever going to be able to decide what you see. You can see good or you can see bad, but you're the one looking. When I get to the airport, I'm going to get inside my car. Alcoholics Anonymous is an inside job. I spent most of my life believing if I could make the outside look good enough, the inside would feel better. Until I came here and you showed me how to work from the inside out. And I'm going to get inside my car and I'm not going to see Toyota. I'm going to see Porsche. 911. Targa. It's triple black with a moonroof. Got a Bose CD system in it with a 12-disc changer. And I'm going to hit those power windows. And I'll drive to work. You know, through the job I didn't used to have when I was drinking. And there I'll see my friends. Those will be the friends I didn't used to have when I was drinking. You know, I don't know who has your message. Are you waiting for somebody with 60 or 70 years of sobriety? Because maybe today the messenger God sent for you to hear isn't even going to get sober for 60 or 70 more minutes. I got a message on the first step about 19 years ago. I was invited to Indiana to speak. And my wife couldn't go with me that weekend, so I took one of my new guys with me. I didn't want to take my car because I didn't think my car would make it to Indiana. So I took my wife's car. She was driving a Honda Civic back then. You know, in a Honda Civic, what do you get in a Honda Civic? 40, 400, 500 miles to the gallon, right? You drive a Honda Civic pretty much from now on, right? Never had to put gas in a Honda Civic. And we jumped in my car, headed for Valparaiso, Indiana, me and my new guy. We got past a sign that said my exit was about 5 exits away. And I looked down at the gas gauge, and the gas gauge said empty. And I thought, well, yeah, empty like in a real car empty, right? But in a Honda Civic empty, you've got to have 100 miles left. I never gave it another thought. Until we went underneath the sign that said my exit was 2 miles. And as soon as I got underneath that sign, I ran out of gas. If you got a Honda Civic and it says empty, oh, they're dead serious about that. That's exactly what they mean. Now, I coasted for another mile, and I pulled over to the side of the road. And there I was in the middle of Indiana, out of gas. Got a new guy sitting next to me. You know, I don't even want to turn and look at him. I just spent the better part of about 4 hours telling him about responsibility and stuff like that. But I couldn't sit in Indiana the rest of my life. I had to do something. But I turned, I looked at him, and he just grinned. You know how they are. They'll stay sober a long time waiting for you to do something wrong just so they can point it out. And he looked at me and he said, "We're powerless, ain't we?" I said, "Yeah, you bet we are." I said, "What do you think we ought to do about it?" He said, "Well, I think we better admit it." So, you know, I could have sat there the rest of my life and gone, vroom, vroom, vroom. Until I admit there's a problem, I'm never going to get anywhere. I don't know who has your message. Are you listening? I know today how to live resentment-free, huh? I didn't say I did. I said I know how to. And I don't know what they tell you over here when you come in. They got this thing in the States. It's just another one of those things we tell newcomers. You know what they told me? They say, pray for your enemies, huh? They tell you that over here? I thought, Jesus. Now, I don't know about you. When I got here, I had a couple of resentments. Maybe you guys came here all well-adjusted and everything. I had a couple of resentments like my ex-wife, the plaintiff. She left with my dynasty, right? But I still want to do something nice for her. Like maybe buy her a new car. Something like a 72 Pinot with no brake lights, you know? So I go to see, and you guys are telling me pray for my enemies. So I go to see my little brother. My little brother's a born-again Christian. He's always got a Bible with him. And I said, these knuckleheads in Alcoholics Anonymous are telling me to pray for my enemies. And he says, it's true, Tim, you should. And you see, my God loves me so much that he allows me to hear things the way he knows I will. Not the way you think I should, but the way he knows I will. And my little brother says, it's true, Tim, you should pray for your enemies. It tells us to in the Bible. I said, no, it don't. He said, yeah, it does. And he went and he got his Bible. Do you know what it says in the Bible? It says, praying for your enemies is like heaping hot coals upon their heads. Now, I liked that. That's not what you told me. But that's the way my God knew I needed to hear it. In order for me to get home and kneel down and mention my enemies to him. And do you know, once I kneel down, my God doesn't care what I say. If I go home tonight and I say, dear God, please let all of my enemies go to heaven tomorrow. God's interested in my actions, not my words. I take one word out of each of the last three steps, and that's how I live my life today. Continued, improve, and practice. Now, each one of those words is an action word. You got to do something if you want something. My book says half measures avail me nothing. Doesn't say half measures avail me half. It says nothing. And I don't know about you. I don't want any more nothing. I want everything my God wants me to have. And I don't even know what that is. But if he wants it for me, I want it too. There's a difference in my life today I want to share with you. I go to the penitentiaries and the prisons in the States to visit the guys. And for a long time, I wasn't able to go. I got sick. I had hepatitis C and went through the interferon treatment for it, and it damn near killed me. I lost 35 pounds and a bunch of my hair and every bit of my energy, and I just wasn't well enough to go. And I had other responsibilities I had to attend to, so I wasn't able to go in. And they changed the rules in the States. It was a funny thing. All of a sudden, they want you to fill out this application so you can go into the penitentiaries. You see, I never had to fill an application out to get into a penitentiary before. I was always pre-approved when I got there. You know, they were waiting on me. But about 25, 26 years ago, I was at a penitentiary in Western Ohio, and I gave a little talk. And after the talk, a guy came up to me and he said, "Can I call you?" I said, "Well, yeah, you can call me." And I forgot that in the United States, if you're in the penitentiary, you want to call somebody, you got to call collect. But I'll accept a collect phone call in my life today. Let me tell you why. Because on April 10th, 1989, I went to a meeting. There was a young lady speaking at the meeting that night. And I don't know what your sponsor told you. My sponsor had all these little sayings he'd throw at me all the time, right? And my sponsor told me this quite a bit. He said, "Tim, if you go to a meeting and you hear something you like, take it home." Only the sick ones laugh at that. And on October 16th, 1993, we got married. I married a young lady in the Fellowship of Alcoholics. Her name's Mary. I married a very intelligent woman in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, a very educated woman. Now, a lot of her friends didn't think she's so smart when she said she'd marry me. But it's true. My wife is very educated. She's got more letters after her name than I get in my name. She's got a BA. She got an MA. She got an MACT. She was ABD, then she got a PhD. And then she got my personal favorite, the one I liked the best, and that was a J-O-B. One of my new guys asked me once, he said, "Doesn't that intimidate you, that your wife is so intelligent, your wife's so educated, doesn't that intimidate you?" And I had to stop and think about it for a minute, because I never had before. And I said, "No, no, it doesn't intimidate me, it makes me proud. I'm proud as hell of my wife's accomplishments." Because a little over 24 years ago, she came through that door. And she didn't have any letters after her name. But because of a God of her understanding, a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, and the women in her home group that told her, once you come through that door, if you're willing to do the work, you can be anything you want to be. She trusted God, she worked hard, and she accomplished. I can't be intimidated by that. Only proud. I'm proud just to be a member of something that can make that happen. We had an AA wedding. It started with the Serenity Prayer, and it ended with the Lord's Prayer. It had a reading from the 12 and 12 in between. And I was reminded on that day of the chance I got to make a collect phone call from the penitentiary in 1975. And I walked up to the phone and they told me, "You have this much time to call and you can call anybody in the world, but you have to call collect." And I stood there and dialed and I dialed and I dialed and I dialed. And I dialed until I ran out of time. And I couldn't find one person on earth, not one, that would accept a collect phone call for me at that time in my life. Not one. We invited 320 people to that wedding. Do you know how many came? About 350. Now do you see the difference? The difference from then to now. That's the difference in my life. But there is a difference in me. About 12 years ago, my stepfather got real sick, and I had to become his caregiver. I had to help my mom take care of my stepfather, and there weren't two people on earth that hated each other more than me and my stepfather. But he got Alzheimer's disease, and it's a terrible, terrible thing to watch. An Al-Anon once told me it's a lot like what they see as they watch us deteriorate in front of their eyes, and there's nothing they can do about it, and the hopelessness and the helplessness that they feel. And it was getting to be pretty dangerous keeping him at home. He was taking windows off the hinges, and he was taking doors off. He was just escaping at night, and the police were bringing him home. So we had to find another place for him. And they had a veterans hospital not too far from the house, about an hour and a half from us. And we put him in there, and they took real good care of him. And we'd go visit him every weekend. Me and my mom would go visit him every weekend, and that's what we did. And after about 8 or 9 months, he passed away. And that left me with an 82-year-old mother at home. And mom did pretty good for a long time. She broke her hip a couple times. She had a couple of minor strokes, but she got around the house, and her mind wasn't too bad. And mom didn't want to go into any kind of a home, see? And we had that talk. I said, Mom, look, the first few years of my life, you took care of me. You fed me. You cleaned up my messes. You changed my diapers. If I have to do that for you, the last few years of your life, I would be more than happy to do that. And she looked at me and she said, as only a mother could say, she said, the first few years of your life. The first 30 years of your life. I was blessed because of the people in the fellowship, an understanding wife, understanding business partners. Mom didn't have to go anywhere. She got to stay in her home. I had a woman that came in and took care of her during the day. And in the evenings, I'd go over. And I'd take care of her. And I'd make her dinner, walk her dog, clean her up and get her ready for bed and put her pajamas on and put her in bed. And once we did that, she was fine. And that's what I did during the week. Now, on the weekends, I was there all weekend. And I just did what Mom needed done. And we'd catch up on a lot of things. And that's what I was there all weekend. You know what I like to do on weekends? I like to play golf. That's what I like to do on weekends. But for a long time, I wasn't able to because of the hepatitis C and the interferon treatments. I just didn't have the energy to play. I still had friends that played. But I didn't have the energy to do it, and I was with my mom. And one of them called me once, and he said, Tim, we have an opening in the foursome on Sunday. Would you like to join us? And I said, you know, I'd love to join you, but I won't be able to on Sunday. I'll be with my mom. And he said, do you have to be with your mom on Sunday? And I said, no, I don't. No, I don't have to be with my mom. I get to be with my mom. I get to be with my mom on Sunday. I want to share with you something my mother told me, and I think it's the most valuable thing she ever said to me. Like I told you, I'd get her ready for bed and get her in bed and hang out with her, and then it would be time to go to a meeting. And I'd go in the back, and I'd give her a kiss on her forehead. I'd say, Mom, I'm going to a meeting. I love you. Now, isn't when we tell somebody we love them, we'd like them to say, I love you too, wouldn't we? I love you too. On one particular night, I went back there. I gave my mom a kiss on her forehead. I said, Mom, I'm going to the meeting. I love you. And she didn't say, I love you too. She said something much, much more important. She said, I know you do. I know you do. People should know we love them long before we have to tell them. Is there somebody in your life every once in a while that goes through your mind? I should check on them. I should give them a call. I should see how they're doing. Quit thinking about it. Quit thinking about it and do it. It's really hard to make amends at the funeral home. On June 1st, 2005, I was kneeling next to my mother's bed, and I was holding her hand. And at 4:45 on that day, the angels came. They took her hand from mine, and they put it in God's. And I was able to do something that day that I learned here. You taught me, and I'll never be grateful enough. You taught me how to let go and let God. That's another difference in my life. Do you want to know the real difference? The biggest difference? On the weekends, I'll go visit my mom. At the cemetery, I'll take her flowers. And I'd like to believe she sees me. I don't know. I don't know if she does or not. I'd like to believe she does. But do you know why I take my mom flowers? Because I said I would. And that's the big difference. Thank you so very much for listening to me.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.